Hello, this is Terrence McNally. Late summer 2004, I recorded interviews with Thomas Frank on What's the Matter with Kansas and with George Lakoff on Don't Think of an Elephant. We were deep in two wars at the time and 3 months ahead of the Bush-Kerry election. And I suspect they've got a lot to say to us as we head into these 2018 midterms. First, Thomas Frank.
Why does a factory worker who listens to Rush Limbaugh consistently vote for the political party less likely to protect his safety, his job, and his pension? In What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America? Author Thomas Frank returns to his native state to examine Republican success in building an alliance, an unholy alliance, between blue-collar Midwesterners and Wall Street multimillionaires. Thomas Frank joins me on Free Forum in a couple of minutes. Why does the pro-life Kansas factory worker who listens to Rush Limbaugh repeatedly vote for that party? Why do blue-collar workers all over America embrace a moral agenda focused on things like opposition to abortion and gay marriage and support for school prayer consistently vote against their own interests? As Democrats and Republicans battle for voters in swing states, Thomas Frank looks to his traditionally red-voting native state of Kansas to examine the GOP's success in building those alliances. What can the Sunflower State tell us about why struggling Americans would vote for Republicans and against their own families and their futures? Now, here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Now, Thomas Frank, What's Wrong with Kansas? The bio on his own website reads, "Born on the wild plains of Kansas, Tom pulled himself up by his bootstraps, learned to read, write, and cipher. He likes big steaks, barbecue, and most other meat dishes." Now, let me also add that he's the founding editor of The Baffler, and that's www.thebaffler.com. BAFFLER.com, a book of essays and critiques of culture. He's also the author of a couple of really good books, One Market Under God and The Conquest of Cool. And he was a guest on this show previously when The Conquest of Cool came out, which is an analysis of advertising, basically primarily since the 50s and 60s, and the co-optation of the rebel posture by advertisers to use the very fact that people might want to rebel as a way to stimulate their consumption. He's a contributor to Harper's, The Nation, and the New York Times op-ed page. Welcome again, Thomas Frank, to KPFK and Free Forum.
How you doing, Terrence?
I'm good.
That was pretty funny that you read that bio. We put that up there as a joke, and then I just never got around to taking it down.
Well,
I learned to read, write, and cipher.
That's right, and I figured you probably did.
Yeah.
You've been ciphering good ever since you got to the University of Chicago.
That's right.
So first, briefly, Thomas, I always want to ask people a bit about their own past so that listeners get to know the people behind the ideas and the work. Now, what were you like growing up in Kansas? When did you leave? And what made you return there to write this book?
Okay. Good question. I grew up in a very affluent suburb of Kansas City, and I was a teenage conservative, if you can imagine that. Very different person than I am today. Although I still liked barbecue, steaks, and most other meat dishes. To refer to that.
Yes.
Okay, but anyhow. I was a big fan of Ronald Reagan, if you can imagine that. And what had happened, as I look back on those years, I sort of internalized the politics of the world that I was growing up in. The adults around me who were, you know, all businessmen and all very well-to-do, and regarded things like taxation as being fundamentally illegitimate. Government was just a nest of criminals, and so were labor unions and all this sort of thing.
Right. Let me just tell you, Thomas, that I think in our teenage years we have all sorts of motivations. I recall my parents both being from Massachusetts, both being Catholic, both being lifetime Democrats. I actually was the one in the household who said, well, this Nixon guy isn't so bad, you know, in 1960.
Wow.
You know, we rebel in whatever ways we can, or we go along in whatever ways we can.
Yeah,
continue.
I was basically going along.
Yeah.
What changed it for me was when I got out into the wider world and discovered that business wasn't the kind of perfect meritocracy that these adults had told me that it was, and that, the free market system just, it wasn't a system that just rewarded people based strictly on their merit and was fair and all that. So, I mean, you know, all the usual things. And this occurred to me when I finally, and so I left Kansas for good about 1987 and moved to Chicago. And why did I go back there to write this book? Well, what happened was, in about 99 or the year 2000 or something like that, a friend of mine, I was at a wedding, and a friend of mine from Kansas City was getting married, and he said, he had kept in touch with all the political goings on there, and he said, you know, those people that you grew up around that you used to think were the most Republican people you would ever meet, well, those people are now, you know, the people in this affluent suburb that I was describing earlier, well, those people are now on the left edge of the spectrum back in Kansas, and because the state has moved so far to the right, and that was about the same time as the evolution issue. Kansas decided they would fight over evolution again.
Right.
And that was making national headlines. And that's when I said, "Wow, I should look into this and see what's happened there." And it sort of coincided with my larger historical interest in the problem of or the mystery of blue collar conservatism, populist conservatism.
Right. Right. Let me say that one of the reasons that I wanted to talk with you. I got the book, looked at the book, saw you on C-SPAN and so on. But you're focusing on one of the questions that most troubles me about politics and democracy over at least the last 30, 35 years, okay?
Yeah.
Which is people voting against their own interests. Last year, I was asked to guest on a radio show, and the subject was the future of the Democratic Party. I said, you know, I'm not really that interested in the horse race of the future of the Democratic Party. I said,
right.
What I'm interested in is what would it take to once again have a party in this country that would do two things, that would serve the interests of the majority of Americans, and that would find a way to successfully communicate that fact to voters.
Yeah.
That's kind of what you're...
Isn't that funny? And that seems like such a rational thing to want. It seems so normal. And yet...
That's kind of what you're after in this, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. And that's so far... I mean, it's farther... That farther from being, you know, reality than ever,
yep.
In my opinion, that we have wandered off into a place where we are so distant from that, where our politics are all about these cultural issues, and if they aren't, then we, you know, if the Democrats start, you know, heaven forbid, you know, return to their roots and start talking about workplace issues and this kind of thing, then there we have one of our two big political parties is standing by ready to invent some new hot-button cultural issue to bring us back onto the path. You know, this year it looks like it's going to be gay marriage is going to be the big thing.
Right. And when a group decides that they've got a quiver, just a shopping cart full of cultural issues, and then they've got terrorism, they've got an awful lot of stuff that can sort of fog the mind, don't they?
Oh yeah.
Now let me see if your numbers are the same as mine. I thought that there were still fewer registered Republicans than Democrats. You, I think somewhere I read, said that it was maybe they'd passed them.
If I did, I think I was in error because I saw the numbers on that the other day, and there are still more Democrats than Republicans. But it's the margin has been closing since the 70s.
And as the independents and fail to to choose
it's
grows.
What is the Republicans have been moving up slightly. The Democrats have been dropping like a rock, and that's basically what's happening.
Right. Let me lay out a big question, and then let me identify the show while you get your answer ready. Okay. So this is it. What we're saying then is Republicans still a slightly fewer Republicans than Democrats, yet the right dominates the White House, the Senate, the House, the Supreme Court, much of the rest of the federal courts, the military, a majority of governorships,
yeah.
And one could say, depending on one's interpretation of media, perhaps the media, and how have they been able to do it? Now, let me tell people that you're listening to Freeform. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Thomas Frank, author of Conquest of Cool, One Market Under God, editor of The Baffler, that is worth checking out at thebaffler.com. And his latest book that we're talking about now is What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. You can learn more about all of this at his own website, which is www.tcfrank, one word, tcfrank.com. Okay, how have they pulled that off?
Well, that is the giant picture, but the thing is that if you were to say that to a Republican, they would immediately point out that in fact they are victims and they are on the receiving end of modern life, because our culture is still being made by Hollywood and these liberal elites in academia and in the media, you know, in the newspapers, and just turn on Fox News sometime. These people understand themselves as victims. They are on the receiving end of history. They cannot. The fact that they control all three branches of government never enters into their thinking. They understand themselves as a victimized majority, fighting back for their rights.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally how they see themselves.
Ever the underdog.
Yeah, ever the underdog. That's a big part of the appeal of the backlash. And by the way, that's my term. That's my term for populist conservatism over the years, from the late 1960s up to the present. And it's I consider it as all more or less one phenomenon, even though it has many different chapters and many different personalities. But we've been in this, we've been in this historical stage ever since the late 60s where conservatives have become the majority and, are able to win elections in this way and that by talking about these hot-button cultural issues and by using the same kind of, conservative pop culture.
And when you say backlash, a backlash against?
Well, it originally started as a backlash against the anti-war movement,
mm-hmm.
In Vietnam. And to some degree, it's a backlash against the civil rights movement. You remember the guy who was its first great leader, was
George Wallace. Yep.
Who was an overt segregationist.
I'll tell you what, let's go down this tributary right now, because one of the questions I was going to ask you is the role of race in this.
Yeah.
As much as you're saying sort of it's about these liberal elites and it's all the use of the cultural issues, Lyndon Johnson said, when he signed the Voting Rights Act, I've just given the South, the Democrats have lost the South, and they did. And George Wallace, anger over integration, didn't that precede and at least for a while exceed any passion over, say, teaching evolution? And how does that fit into fit into your analysis? Of course, in their minds, it probably overlapped, but that's another story.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some people who think those things go hand in hand somehow. I don't know.
But how does that fit in your? How does racism and the role of race, at least as maybe the booster engine that started this?
Yeah, well, that's certainly the case, that the backlash started as a more or less openly racist movement, and a lot of its early chapters were marked by racism. And you think of Nixon's famous Southern strategy. That
mm-hmm.
was the whole idea. There was to put Johnson's prediction into effect, right? And you remember Goldwater, who voted against the Civil Rights Bill and who was the first Republican to win Southern states in a very, very long time. Then you have things like the Boston busing riots, or the Willie Horton, TV commercial, or the career of Jesse Helms, or
right.
Trent Lott.
Right, and let's just remind people, lest they aren't aware, that the Willie Horton commercials were the brainchild of Roger Ailes, who now runs Fox News.
Oh, is that true? I didn't
Fox
know
Network.
That.
Yeah, that was his. That was part. Came out of his shop.
Yeah, but what interests me about the backlash in recent years is that it's tried to turn its back on this racist side. And in fact, you have, right now in the news, one of the leading one of the great exponents of pop conservatism, Alan Keyes,
right.
A black guy running for the U.S. Senate in Illinois. And he is, he's a very interesting guy, very intelligent, amazing public speaker, but, you know, right down the line, as conservative as they come. And this is one of the reasons why I chose Kansas as my as a state to focus on, because, you know, if the backlash has a future, and I think it does, it's not in the sort of racial aspect of it. I
mean, right. In other words, what I'm guessing as I'm listening to you is that the racism was the start, and obviously the smart Nixon money was on that. But then, how long can you say we're the victims of racism? The victims of integration. That yeah. begins to get a little old.
Well,
but
that's racism is something that is so thoroughly discredited.
That's what I mean.
Society, there's almost nobody will stand up.
But if
for
you
it.
Can graft on all these other things onto right. that same feeling.
That's right. In fact, the backlash often today tries to go the other way and tries to use and they will look for any like far-fetched, you know, logical, whatever you call it, you know, any far-fetched way of thinking that they can that would allow them to call Democrats racists. They're constantly on the lookout for this, whether it's, you know, the Social Security issue or school vouchers or something like that. They're always looking out for something like that because they sense that this is the power of this term. And, you know, in the way that it's been used against them. But this is one of the reasons why I focused on Kansas, is because this is a state where the racial side to the backlash is relatively, you know, small. It's,
right.
it's basically not there. I mean, it certainly was there in the past, but the issues that get people riled there are all the culture issues, whether it's abortion, which is the big one, or gun control, or evolution, which was, as I said, was you know.
What is the situation in Kansas on evolution right now?
Well, about a week ago, they had the Republican primary. No, it was on Thursday, so about 5 days ago, they had the Republican primary, and the conservatives. We'll get into this story later, I imagine, but the Republican Party there is where the backlash war is being fought out. There is within the Republican Party, you have two factions. You have the moderate Republicans, who are the old traditional Kansas ruling class, and that's they used to be a progressive Republicans. Some of them even used to be liberal Republicans.
Bob Dole's Republican Party?
Bob Dole would have been on the rightward edge of that, but like Nancy Kassebaum, mm-hmm. House Landon, even Dwight Eisenhower,
mm-hmm.
This kind of Republicanism, in the last 15 years, you've had rising up this group, the conservatives, or the cons, as I call them in the book, the cons versus the mods. But the cons all come from working class neighborhoods throughout the state, and this is the fascinating thing. They explicitly describe their war with the moderates as a class war. You know, it's them against the state's the rulers, the traditional rulers of the state, and they're right up front about that. They acknowledge it all the time. The interesting thing is that they're way to the right, that they've this mm-hmm. class revolt that they are engaged in is a right-wing class revolt. That's what's fascinating. But, well, anyhow, last Thursday they scored a huge victory over the moderates. They tend to win the primaries because they have much greater commitment on their side
sure.
than the moderates do, because the moderates are all on vacation in August, you know, and the conservatives are highly motivated people, and they tend to show up on the primary day and to win. And they scored a big triumph, and they've retaken the state board of education. So they'll probably be bringing the evolution issue back in the next,
oh my
next
God.
Year or two.
Yep.
They'll be on the lookout for
and,
that.
And you'll say, yeah, I'm from Kansas.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, I'm now a professional Kansan.
That's true. So. That's true. You are. Let's go to another piece of this, which is the role of the Democrats.
Yeah.
And you at one point used the phrase, or not at one point, more than one point, used the phrase criminally stupid
yeah.
to describe its strategy and tactics since the 70s. You won't get many arguments in my listenership, but let's explain where they have gone so wrong.
Well, it's you know, when I wrote the book, I was living in Chicago, and it was all more or less theoretical. And my argument was that the Democrats have turned their back on the blue-collar voters that used to be their, obviously, their main constituency. And they
right,
were,
and still were through the Kennedy years.
Yeah, that was who made them the big, you know, the dominant national party in the first place, was when they sort of, you know, in the 1930s were able to start talking about, you know, about issues of social class, economic issues of social class. Before that, we'd sort of been in this kind of, you know, doing the sort of silly culture wars in the 1920s mm-hmm. of prohibition mm-hmm. and that kind of thing.
And then let's go back again and say that the original wedge was racism and was civil rights.
But, absolutely.
But then the Democrats made a bigger mistake.
In my opinion, what the Democrats have done in recent years has been, that's been so catastrophic, is to turn their backs on the traditional working class constituency by moving to the right on economic issues. And you remember Clinton doing this, you know, triangulation, they called it, whether it was NAFTA, whether it was deregulation of various industries, whether it was antitrust. He basically adopted the Reagan agenda on economic issues. And this is something that a lot of people within the Democratic Party had been calling for a long time. Their answer to every defeat, whether it's McGovern's defeat in 72 or Gore's defeat in 84.
Or even Gore's in 2000.
It's always, they've got to move to the right. Look, the Republicans are on the right. We've got to move over there. We've got to keep moving to the right. What's funny is that the Republicans, you know, who started out with this own, you know, catastrophic defeat of their own with Goldwater, they never said, we got to give in, you know, we got to change course. They kept at it. The conservatives kept at it, and eventually they won. But the Democrats seem to think that the way they're going to win is by constantly trimming and constantly adopting bits of the Republican platform, and then they'll be able to appeal to corporate America, and they'll get the money. They'll be able to appeal to these suburban professional voters. That's who they always talk about. Anyhow, I wrote that in the book because when Clinton signed off on NAFTA, this is, in my opinion, when disaster really commenced for these people. That's when they lost the House and the Senate.
And you quote people who I think
who changed their party registration because of that in Wichita, a very blue collar town.
In other words, and let me just make specific that while the Republicans might also have been for NAFTA, they said, I used to be for the Democrats on economic issues. Once they go for NAFTA, then I might as well go to the folks who I agree with on evolution.
That's right. Or evolution hadn't come up yet.
Or
then,
abortion, or church, or anything. Yeah. Prayer in school.
There's no longer a difference between the parties on the issues that matter to me. Therefore, I'm going to vote my conscience on this one. You know, and I'm this is a very religious city, as many places are in America, and that's what happened there. And they lost their Democratic congressman. He was replaced by a far right-wing Republican. They lost their Democratic mayor, also replaced by a very conservative Republican. And they've been moving to the right ever since.
Yep.
I moved to Washington a few months ago. I'd lived in Chicago all these years. I moved to Washington, and since I've been here, I have met many people that I would describe as professional Democrats. They work for the Democratic Party, or they work for some liberal group that's effectively an arm of the Democratic Party. And when I tell them these stories, and I talk to them about blue-collar issues and workplace issues, they sort of roll their eyes, and they say this. They say, you know, there is no working class in America anymore. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And they say something like, you know, manufacturing is no longer an important part of the economy. It's only like 10% of the workforce or something. You know, you've heard this before.
Right, right.
And therefore, those voters are not important. The people we have to worry about are these suburban professionals. And they've got this all worked out in their own mind, and that's why the Democrats keep moving in the direction that they're moving. And I will guarantee you, as sure as the sun is going to rise tomorrow, that when John Kerry goes down to defeat in November, which it now looks like he's going to do, that the Democratic Leadership Council will blame his loss on the fact that he was too far to the left, and they will interpret his defeat as another call for the Democrats to move farther to the right, and this will keep going on, and they'll lose again, and maybe someday they will become what the Republicans say they are today, which is the party of the liberal elite of these wealthy Hollywood people and these wealthy people from Silicon Valley, and that's it.
Quick question, Thomas.
No class constituency at all.
They'll blame it. They'll say, look, what can we do? As long as campaigns are based on television advertising and we've got to, raise the $250, $300 million of the Republicans or the $400, you name it, we've got to do this. What do you say to that?
Well, it's this has been the case ever since the rise of TV, and I understand that worry, that concern. But basically, if that's the case, then the left is done for. And I want to remind you that a guy like Franklin Roosevelt ran for office. The Democrats have always had significantly less money than the Republicans, and in 1936, when he ran against Alf Landon, who was at the time the governor of Kansas, Landon was backed by a huge majority of the newspapers of this country, and back then the newspapers were very partisan in their reporting. This was before objectivity, very partisan. He was backed by Wall Street. He was backed by every imaginable moneyed interest, and they stopped. I mean, they pulled out all the stops to elect that guy, and Roosevelt still won.
Right.
And won by a thundering landslide. It can be done.
You don't just
have to have money in this. You think about these people in Kansas who, the moderate Republicans are the ones with all the money, and yet the conservatives have been able to beat them in election. And it's funny to be drawing our lessons from the right. I mean, it really is.
I know.
The conservatives have been able to beat them in election after election because they have more commitment.
You're saying passionate grassroots will ultimately trump TV ads.
Absolutely. These people go door to door. These people, I met one woman. These are all working class people. I met one woman who was so dedicated to the issue of school vouchers, by the way, which is itself so utterly, bewildering, because Kansas actually, the place where she lives in Kansas, is very good public schools. So into school vouchers and, somehow undermining these public schools. She mortgaged her own house to further her campaign for school vouchers. I mean, these are people, she put herself into debt to fight for an issue that is going to harm people like her in the long run.
Yeah, this is the thing that drives me the craziest. The book is What's the Matter with Kansas? The website is www.tcfrank.com. I've been speaking with Thomas Frank. Thomas, keep up the good work.
All right, well, thank you for having me.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In the second half, you're going to hear my August 2004 conversation with George Lakoff on the power of framing and his book, Don't Think of an Elephant.
On George W. Bush's first day in office in the year 2001, the phrase tax relief started coming out of the White House, and it still is. It was used a number of times in this year's State of the Union address and shows up in campaign speeches 4 years later. Today's guest, George Lakoff, points out that that simple phrase is an ideal example of the Republicans and the right's skillful and consistent use of framing. Think of the framing for relief, he points out. For there to be relief, there must be an affliction, an afflicted party, and a reliever who removes the affliction and is therefore a hero. And to try to prevent that hero from giving that relief, well, those people are villains. So the Democrats tend to counter with their version of tax relief, and there they accept the conservative frame. The conservatives have set a trap. The words draw you into their worldview, and this is what framing is all about. Framing is about getting language that fits your worldview and having that be the language that the conversation takes place in. Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. George Lakoff is a professor of linguistics and cognitive science at the University of California, Berkeley. He previously taught at Harvard and the University of Michigan. He's the author of Metaphors We Live By, Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think, and most recently, Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. Lakoff is also one of the founders of and a senior fellow at the Rock Ridge Institute, a progressive think tank in Oakland, California. One of the goals of the Rock Ridge Institute is to reframe the terms of political debate to make a progressive moral vision more persuasive and influential. You can learn more about their work and George Lakoff's work at www.rockridgeinstitute. That's one word, rockridgeinstitute.org. Welcome, George Lakoff, to KPFK and Free Forum.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. First, briefly, I always like listeners to get a little feel for the people behind the ideas. So why did you become a linguist, and when and how did you turn your attention to politics?
Well, I became a linguist way back in the 1960s, simply because it was very interesting. I was extremely interested in how the mind worked, and linguistics was a very good way to get at it. I got into politics later on. I was involved in the 1980s in looking at the language of discussion between the Soviet Union and the U.S., during the Glasnost period.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was doing that, I started looking at U.S. foreign policy and the framing behind U.S. foreign policy, and particularly the metaphors used to define U.S. foreign policy. And that got me into, during the Gulf War, doing a critique of the way that U.S. foreign policy was used during the Gulf War. Then later on, a few years later, 1994, I was looking at the 94 election, reading the Contract with America and so on, and I got very confused. The confusion was simple. I looked at the positions of conservatives and liberals, and I asked myself, of conservatives, I'm a liberal, why should anybody who is against abortion also be for the flat tax? What does taxation have to do with abortion?
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked, well, why the people who are against, who are for the flat tax, why are they in favor of tort reform? And what does tort reform have to do with any of the other positions, positions on foreign policy, being against the United Nations, and so on? If you start looking at the various policies that you know, conservatives have, they don't seem to fit together in any rational way. And so I said, gee, this is very odd. Suppose that I look at my own views, which are exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
How do they fit together? And I got embarrassed.
Because the same was true.
The same was true. I couldn't explain it. And so I started doing this as a problem in cognitive science and linguistics. I asked, what could define a worldview so that all of these things made sense? Because I'd actually studied a lot of things like this before. I'd studied conceptual systems and worldviews. And what I found was typical of differing worldviews. When you go to talk to a conservative, the conservative will say, you know, that liberals are irrational. You talk to liberals, the liberals will say conservatives are irrational. You ask, for example, a liberal friend, what do they think about, why are conservatives irrational? They say, how can you be pro-life and for the death penalty?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you talk to a conservative friend, and they say, how can you liberals not want to put a murderer to death but sanction abortion? And everybody thinks the other side is irrational. Now, this is extremely common, and so I tried to figure that one out. And in doing the research, I started looking at linguistic phenomena, in particular the language of morality.
Mm-hmm.
I had done a big study on the language of morality and on the metaphors around the world used for morality, and found that liberals and conservatives had different metaphors for morality. So I started listing them. You know, for example, who talks about, you know, backbone motives,
mm-hmm,
of morality, and so on. And again, I just didn't understand it. I had a nice long list. And I was trying to figure out what would explain it. And finally, I went to the family values literature. And I started looking at that, and I realized that a student of mine had done a paper on the metaphor of the nation as family. And so I said, okay, let's look at what that metaphor would say. I mean, after all, we have founding fathers.
That's right.
And everybody, nobody questions it. Nobody says, what? What
yeah.
do you mean? You know, they all understand that perfectly well. So I worked out the details of that metaphor, and I said, look, if we have two different views of the nation, maybe we have two different views of the family. So I basically put what I had, you know, my list of mysteries into the output of this metaphor, looked at what the input would have to be to explain it, and out popped two views of the family, a strict father family and a nurturing parent family.
So let me repeat those. That's a strict father or a nurturing parent. And by the way, let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum. I'm host Terry McNally speaking with George Lakoff, professor of linguistics at the University of California and author of Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think. And most recently, Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. And you can learn more at rockridgeinstitute.org. And where we're getting to is the two different moral frames that conservatives and progressives or liberals hold, and it's how they see the world. Nurturing parent on one hand, strict father on the other.
Okay, well, here's how it goes. If you are have a strict father view of the family, then you generally have the following background assumptions. that the world is fundamentally dangerous, that it is fundamentally competitive, that there will always be winners and losers, and that children are born bad in the sense that they just want to do what they want to do rather than to do what's right. You need a strict father, therefore, in the family to defend the family in the dangerous world, support it in the competitive, difficult world, and to teach kids right from wrong. And the assumption is the only way to teach kids right from wrong is some sort of punishment, either a withdrawal of love and affection or physical punishment, which is the usual kind of case. Although withdrawal of love and affection as a punishment is another form of it. Now, in this, there's a consequence. The assumption is that if a child is punished, when he does wrong, then he will learn not to do wrong. That is, he will become internally disciplined and therefore do what's right and not what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption also is that this is the only way that moral people are created.
Mm-hmm. And then they have also an interesting idea of what moral people achieve.
Exactly. That is, if you are disciplined enough to be moral, then you're disciplined enough to pursue your self-interest and become prosperous. So prosperity and morality are linked together. And if you're not prosperous, then you're not disciplined. You're lazy. You're, not able even to be a moral person. So that is part of that worldview. And so the good children are the ones who become disciplined and therefore can be both moral and prosperous. And the bad children are those who lack discipline, who need to be supported, and also who, basically cannot control themselves well enough to do the right thing and not the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. And so once you, now, for those who maybe turn in the middle of that, I'm speaking with George Lakoff, and he kind of worked backwards from looking at the positions conservatives and liberals take in our current political world, and then saying what unites them, settles on this idea of it's a moral view of the world. It's a morality. And then what you found was you could end up with that moral view, the strict father or the nurturing parent, kind of everything would sort of fit together then.
Yeah, it all makes sense.
For and example. I think that part where the achievement of wealth and success equates with being a moral and good person is kind of the real cherry on the top of it, because it then adds kind of almost another layer to all of this that allows, tax cuts for the rich to be a positive thing. Let me ask then, just so people can get this, that's the investigation you did. You say there's a scientific basis in neuroscience and cognitive science for this, just so that people don't think, oh, this is George Lakoff's good idea. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. First, we know from a lot of studies in cognitive science that people think metaphorically. That's not exactly strange. That most reasoning is unconscious. This is usually not something you're aware of. And that people think in terms of conceptual frames, that all words are defined relative to conceptual frames, and conceptual frames are instantiated there in your brains, so that, once you have a certain way of thinking about something, the fact is not going to alter that and so on. So, yes, they are there in your brains.
Okay. Now, just for, again, just a quick example to flesh this out and try to make this one brief. I've got a number of questions for you, and we're about halfway through, or nearly so. Reagan and Clinton are pretty much acclaimed as our top two natural political personalities of the last 30 years. Did they demonstrate this, and can you show listeners how they did so they begin to get the idea in practice?
Sure. Let me talk first about what the nurturant model is.
And oh, good. Yeah.
Clinton really
did
it very well. The nurturant model says that your job as a parent is to nurture your children and to raise them to be nurturers of others. And that's two things. Nurturance is empathy and responsibility, both for yourself and for others. and therefore you're to raise your children to be empathetic to others and to be responsible for themselves and others. And from empathy, you get a lot of values in a nurturing parent family, which turn out to be exactly the progressive values. So if you care about your children, you'll protect them. And so you get things like worker protection, environmental protection, consumer protection, and so on in politics. If you care about your children, then you'll want them to be fulfilled in life, and therefore the government should want the citizens to be fulfilled in life. And you can't be fulfilled if you're not free, and so freedom becomes a value. That's why liberty and the pursuit of happiness go together. Then you have fairness. You want your child to be treated fairly. So fairness becomes a value. There's no freedom without opportunity, and no opportunity without prosperity. So creating opportunity and prosperity become progressive values. Then you don't live alone. As Hillary Clinton says, it takes a village
mm-hmm.
to raise a child. Community, building community and maintaining it is a value. And community service is a particular value. You can't function in a community without cooperation. No cooperation without trust, no trust without honesty and open communication. So cooperation, trust, honesty, and open communication become progressive values. And that's it. From those you get other progressive values,
mm-hmm.
like equality. But basically, that's the set.
So now you've seen laid out the two,
right.
The strict parent and the nurturing family, and they allow you sort of as a bucket or a basket to kind of hold and draw from all your stands really on an awful lot of positions. So again, a quick example of Reagan with his strict parent and Clinton with his nurturing family.
Well, Clinton first, you look at him and you say, there's a nurturer.
Mm-hmm.
He feels your pain. He connects with you. That's what he's about. And that's what his policies were about. His policies were about trying to help people, as he says, helping people to help themselves,
mm-hmm.
that is, to become self-reliant, but giving them the care that was necessary. And that's crucial throughout all of what he was saying. Now, Reagan had the other idea that, people should help themselves, period. That is, they need to be disciplined, and if they're not disciplined, then they're worthless. So the idea here, he would rail against welfare. Why?
Right.
Well, in a strict father family, you're not supposed to become dependent. You're supposed to become independent through being disciplined. Well, think about what that says about social programs. It says social programs give people things they don't earn and therefore make them undisciplined and therefore make them dependent.
So it's actually immoral.
It's actually immoral
to give them that hand because you're then creating you're creating a weak morality
right.
for
and
them.
So,
and the other piece of this is that the unfettered free market is based in that strict father morality. So anything that follows from that, right? That if a corporation is successful, it's because they've And the owners of that corporation are successful. It's because they've had the discipline and they've done the things necessary. They're moral people, and thus that's why they're successful.
That's exactly right. That's why the Democratic argument against tax cuts going to the top 1% doesn't hold any water with poor conservatives who say, "Well, they're rich. They earned it. They deserve it."
Right.
There's a false understanding of the electorate among Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats seem to believe that voters vote their self-interest.
Right. Or they get very, and I myself included, get very frustrated by the fact that they don't.
Yeah.
Like there must be some magic key here that's going to get them to vote their self-interest, and then everything will turn around.
Right.
And you're saying that perhaps the key is a change in framing. Let me ask.
Voters vote their values.
And their identities, right?
A candidate who represents their values. And so poor conservatives look for a strict father candidate.
Mm-hmm. So even though that strict father might not actually serve their interest, their interest, their self-interest is trumped by their values and their identification with the successful and the strict.
Exactly right.
And boy, is that a tough one. So let me ask for a clarification of how a couple of things fit into this agenda, this analysis. I'm Terry McNally speaking with George Lakoff. He's a professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley, author of Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think. That's a sort of a lengthy book that really lays this out in a big way. And then recently of a book that you can pick up through a number of progressive websites or Amazon or probably Rockridge, which is called Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. I have it here. It's how many pages? I'm sure you know. It comes out just over 100. And it is basically, it's more than the Cliff Notes, but it's a workbook, basically. It's a how-to. If you want to learn what's going on and how to begin to reframe, pick up Don't Think of an Elephant. And the website is www.rockridgeinstitute, that rockridgeinstitute, one word, .org. I have taken to giving my best take on advice recently, and I would love to give you a couple of the things I've been saying. This was like my unsolicited advice to carry in the campaign, and see your framing analysis of where I'm on the mark or where I'm not, because I think this begins to get us into the nitty-gritty, okay? One thing I said a few weeks ago was that people get their messages by telling stories, and maybe these wouldn't be the trivializing stories. That this is what I said at the time, and now as I've been thinking about your stuff, maybe I was being too condescending there, of the welfare mom in the Cadillac, okay, that Reagan used to go to. But that there is a story in every communication, and your communication either tells a story or fits and reinforces a larger story. And that the right, all their claims and attacks tell stories, flip-flop, nuance, sensitive, all part of a story. Trial lawyer, even, tells a story. War on terror, war president tells a story. I'd even say Massachusetts, when they say it, tells a story. And that you cannot fight a story with facts, you fight by offering a different or better story. Then people will listen to your facts. Is that similar to framing?
That's exactly what it is. Look, take trial lawyer. What you have, there's a particularly vicious commercial against Edwards that came out very recently. I just viewed it this morning on the web. What you have is the view that it's trial lawyers who are, one, that they're greedy, two, that all their lawsuits are frivolous, and three, that it's only the trial lawyers who are increasing the cost of health care.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Utterly false, every single one of those. But what I've suggested was, you know, which the campaign has not adopted at all, is to reframe simple. Trial lawyers are public protectors against unscrupulous and negligent companies.
And you would think, having had the CEO and major corporation corruption scandals of the last few years, that would land these days.
And not only that, tobacco. I mean,
of course,
we have lots of cases like this, and moreover, this is the last line of protection you have.
If you're a little man, this is it.
This is it, because once the doors to the courtroom become closed, once the juries can no longer, say that these guys have to be fined $100 million, then you have no protection at all against unscrupulous or negligent corporations.
And one of the things that you point out that's a detail in this is that they will say, well, we're only talking about the excessive ones. We just want to cap the penalties, cap the punitive damages and so on. What that does is that disincentivizes those lawyers who would want to take on these cases. And when you do that, it's a chilling effect that you don't have to legislate them against taking them on. They just will be less likely to do so.
That's exactly right. So
right.
What will happen is, as soon as you cap these things, you make it economically impossible for lawyers to take on the cases, because those lawyers have to put in a huge investment
right.
in each case.
Right. And let me go to another one then. A couple of weeks ago, I said, more than ever, America craves authenticity. Bush enjoys a, quote, unfair advantage, my term, because he means what he says. And that was a lot of Howard Dean's appeal. Clinton and Bush have a gift that they can mean whatever they say. Kerry does not. That means he has to tell the truth. He has to stop calculating and second-guessing what swing voters want to hear. Speak his truth over and over again, and for every swing voter he loses, he'll gain many, many more not undecided, but probably people who weren't going to vote at all who go, oh, there's two authentic candidates running. Now I can listen to their views. But until he'll never make it a debate on the issues until people see him as equally authentic to George Bush.
Well, I think that's right, but he has to do even more than that.
Okay.
Which he started to do. He has actually started telling those truths. And he has to show that Bush is not authentic.
There you go.
That is that Bush is.
And can that be done?
Oh, absolutely. There are several ways in which he gets done. The first is what he's already started to do, that he's not leveling with the American people. He's not telling them about how badly the war is going.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't telling them that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. He was, colluding on this, that, and the other thing. There's a whole website called misleader.org.
Oh, yeah. And MoveOn sends out one every day.
Every day.
Greenwatch sends out one on the environment every day.
Yeah, Greenwatch on the environment. And then CAP, Center for American Progress.
Sends out the progress report every day. Exactly. By the way, let's give out these addresses. That's MoveOn.org. Is it CAP.org? Or?
Not sure. Center for American Progress.
Yeah, just put in Google. Center for American Progress. These people will send you every day an update on some deception, some misleading, something like that, that you can then use as fuel when you're staging your arguments. Let me ask you a third one, and this is the one that suddenly struck me last night, and I want to know how it fits a frame. And that is that this administration are ideologues, probably a word you can't use, true believers, maybe a word you can't use, but that they ignore evidence and facts that contradict their beliefs. You look at tax cuts, you look at the war in Iraq, you look at global warming, they just don't care. You could even look at the Medicare bill, AIDS prevention. They don't care about facts. They've got a belief and they're following it. Is there a way that that can be framed in a way that's persuasive because it's so consistently true?
Well, they're basically in denial. And they're in denial about how their ideology fits the world. But there's a further problem with that, which is they may truly believe what they say.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if you have a frame that is so strong that everything you do and everything you see has to fit that frame, you may not even notice what the facts are. Since your frame defines what common sense is, any facts will just seem nonsensical. They would have to be wrong.
So how do you put this in a way that someone who doesn't necessarily agree with them but is being kind of pulled along by their apparent authenticity?
Well,
by that wonderful they set up before Kerry ever won the primaries that if he was the winner, flip-flopping was going to be the accusation.
Well, I mean, you can say, look, they're kidding themselves. They're in denial. They're constantly they want to believe what they say, but it ain't true.
And once you can set up that frame, and then, this is what I'm thinking, is you don't have to then make a paragraph-long critique as an answer all the time. You go, see, there they go again.
Yeah.
Boom, there
yeah.
they go again.
There
Am I correct
go.
That
Hitting
this is...
yourself again.
This is the shortcut that they use that we need to use.
Exactly. You need to have some two-word thing. Whether it's, you need to take Reagan's there you go again and
yep.
just add something like there you go again, still kidding yourself.
Yep. And then finally the upshot is, okay, they're doing it, but it's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous in a world that we're in now. It's dangerous in the deficits we're creating. It's dangerous, and so it's not harmless. It's
dangerous. It's hurting you. It's already killed 1,000 of our guys.
Right. Okay, I've got to close us. This has been great. The book is Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. You can get it from several sites on the net, the ones we mentioned. And George Lakoff's website, where you can learn more about this, is rockridgeinstitute.org. One word, Rockridge Institute. Thank you to Maggie Lepique, my engineer, to Mark Maxwell and Stan Mizrahi in production, and Matt Perez in traffic. Thank you, George Lakoff. Keep up the good work.
It's a pleasure to be here, Terry.
To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, articles, and so on, you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can listen to podcasts there at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. You've been listening to Free Forum. And this is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Try and get up every morning, day after day, and work for a living. Let's see him try that. Then we'll see who's the real tough guy. The working man is the tough guy.
With me, Joe Wilson, a wealth management advisor with a big money management house.
More money, yo money, Joe money.
I get an opportunity to help people turn their money into memories.
We're happy to get the kind of money that jingles, but we'd rather get the kind that folds.
Not your grandpa's financial show. This is your money guy, Joe Wilson, on Progressive Voices Network.
What's going on, my money mavens and moolah misfits? It's me, your money guy, Joe Wilson of the Joe Knows Money Show, reporting live on Progressive Voices Network, delivering you 4 minutes of money news you can use. Trending this week in money news, according to the USA Today Small Business Barometer, the best time to own a small business is now. However, as many entrepreneurs discover, raising money to fund a small business isn't for the faint of heart. Only 46% of small firms received some or all of the financing they sought in 2014, according to a 10-state survey by the Federal Reserve Banks of New York, Atlanta, Cleveland, and Philadelphia. That leads me to my next topic, 5 creative ways to fund your small business. Number 1. Private placements, which is selling equity directly to hand-picked individuals to raise money. Find such investors through online platforms such as AngelList, CircleUp, and EquityNet. Number 2. Community banks. Big banks can be tough to interest early on, so your best shot at finding a lender may be at a community bank. According to Biz2Credit, an online matchmaker between borrowers and lenders, lending approval rates at small banks were 49.6% in April, compared to 21.7% at big banks with $10 billion or more in assets. Number 3. Online financing sites. If you can't qualify for a bank loan, check out the growing number of internet-based financing companies that offer short-term cash infusions via the web. These sources range from peer-to-peer lending like Prosper and Lending Club, where individuals and institutional investors lend you money through the platform, to merchant cash advance providers, which offer an immediate cash infusion in exchange for a share of your future revenues. Number 4. Hedge fund, endowment funds, and family offices. In the past few years, these type of large investment pools have been looking for new ways to enhance their return by lending to small businesses. These lenders behave more like banks than online financing companies and often are willing to make longer term loans. Get access to their money through online platforms such as Biz2Credit, Funding Circle, and Lending Club. Number 5. Third-party loan guarantees. With banks more eager to lend to small business but still using stringent lending criteria, third-party loan guarantees are becoming more popular in recent years. In these deals, an entrepreneur teams up with a private investor known as an angel to get a bank loan that the angel personally guarantees. In return for doing so, the angel gets equity in the business. Now it's time for Joe's money trap of the day, taking on a business partner. Most people give away equity up front to a partner. Yes, there are examples of partnerships that work, but most do not. Unless you are absolutely sure about your partnership, hire people to help you out instead. Here is Joe's money grab of the day. Start a business now. You take on the risk and you reap all of the rewards. There's no question that owning your own business is a risky proposition, but with risk comes reward. The better you are at managing risk, the more reward you reap. And now it's time for Joe's quote of the day. 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things that you didn't do than the ones that you did do. So throw off your bow lines, sail away from the safest harbor, catch the trade winds in your sails, explore, dream, discover. That is a quote by Mark Twain. You are listening to the Joe Knows Money Show on Progressive Voices Network. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Joe Knows Money and on Twitter at Joe Knows Money.
Hey everybody, this is Randy Rhodes with the good news and the bad news and the good news. So here's the good news. The Progressive Voices audience has grown. It has grown so huge. It's nearly a million regular listeners now. That's great. Yeah, but here's the bad news. Our bandwidth costs have grown too. And we've tried to protect the limited commercial nature of this stream, but to keep up with costs, we absolutely positively need your help now. You might say we're the victims of our own success. A million regular listeners now, but the cost of operating a stream like that has grown beyond our wildest expectations. So I know you want to continue enjoying my show and Stephanie's show and Tom's show and Mike Malloy and Leslie Marshall, Nicole Sandler's What's News, Brad and Desi's Green News Report. And if you want that, and if you believe in that, then the free mobile Progressive Voices platform needs you to pitch in right now. And here's how you do it. Go to progressivevoices.com, progressivevoices.com, and press the donate button. That's progressivevoices.com and press the donate button. Thank you.